Hello and welcome to another episode of The Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, I am sitting here with John and Elio, and we're actually doing an interview together.
Yes, for the first time in several weeks, I am John and Elio. I write songs about science fiction, fantasy, and other nerdy things. You can get most of my music as Pay What You Want, even free, over at johnandelio.bandcamp.com, including my new EP, the Books, Bytes, and Bots EP, which has songs about George R.R. Martin and Steve Jobs and lots of interesting nerdy things. So go and check that out.
Did you know Bandcamp was down today?
I did know that because when we posted the link to today's podcast, it didn't show up. And I'm like, no.
I noticed that, yeah. It was
It was only down for a little while. It wasn't down for very long, but...
I wonder if they're attached to Amazon, to like the cloud, because Amazon's little cloud issue like last week totally mm-hmm. borked one of my work databases.
Mm-hmm.
And I had... we lost a database completely. It's like gone.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because I was listening to another podcast and they were talking about it being down. And when I saw Bandcamp down, I'm like, I wonder if they use Amazon. They might, because they're kind of a smaller company. I would imagine that they might use it. So anyway, but it was back up pretty quickly. So no worries there. But anyway, this week on the show, we have Peter Aurelian. He's got a book out from Tor called The Unremembered, excellent fantasy novel. I highly recommend it. Peter and I sort of met up through Twitter and Facebook and all that jazz, and he's a big fan of progressive rock, and he's a singer, and he sings in progressive rock bands, and he works for Xbox, and he writes fantasy novels. He's living the good life. He really
You know what I don't get?
What's that?
You and I both signed up for like all these different things. I don't get any books from Tor. I have been a huge supporter of Tor. They don't send me squat.
You know, Tor doesn't send me anything either. Peter and I just got to be friendly online, and they sent me his book. I don't get anything else. So if Tor is listening to this and they want to send us books, you can give us a call. We'll take your books. That's fine. But anyway, so.
I love Tor. I've always been surprised that Tor has never replied and never sent us anything.
Oh, they're a big.
Anyway, they don't need us. They don't need us.
Okay. Anyway, so hope you enjoyed this interview. We talked about the fantasy novels, and we talked about music, and we talked a little bit about Xbox and digital media and transit. Lots of really interesting stuff. So I hope you people enjoy the interview today. And here you go. And with us on the line tonight, we have author Peter Aurelian. Peter's got a novel out from Tor called The Unremembered, which is a fantasy novel. I'm about 200 pages into it, and it is excellent. I'm really enjoying it. Peter's got a lot of other stuff going on. He's also a musician. He sings in some progressive rock bands. He happens to work for Xbox. Got a lot of cool stuff going on, but we're here mostly to talk about his new book. So, Pete, say hello.
Greetings, all.
Peter is right in my wheelhouse in terms of what I enjoy and my interest between the music and the fantasy novels. So, Peter, before we get into anything else, I think we should probably talk a little bit about the book and talk a little bit about getting published through Tor. I was telling Patrick before we started recording that I believe this is the first in a 6-part series. Is that the plan?
Yeah, you know, I get asked this a lot, and it's a fair question, since, you know, there's a lot of fantasy series out there. This is probably one of the strongest years for epic fantasy that I can remember. And there's some sensitivities, I think, that readers have. You know, what I say is this, because I am a reader of a lot of those series, I don't have any interest in protracting the story I've written. Torbot 3... that's not the end of the story arc that I've conceived. I know what happens through those three, and I know the end with a lot of clarity. And I know broad strokes between the end of book three and the end of the series. I've still some work to do to flesh out the rest of that. But what I've told folks is I'll close this series down as soon as it starts to wind down. My intuition is that it's 6 books. It could be that it's fewer. And I've got at least 3 other, you know, fairly involved projects that are waiting to be written. So I'll focus on Vault of Heaven, which is the series name for now, and then move on.
Great. Now, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the first book that's out and tell a little bit about some of the characters in the world that you are developing?
Sure. You know, I often describe this. It's hard to do a lot of the. I'm not good at summarizing my own work. What I say is, I actually don't like synopsis kind of altogether, simply because I think getting something into such a tight frame, it's reductive to the point that you kind of lose the point. And so I'm bad at it. I don't think that publishers are particularly good at it either. And so to that end, I usually pick up the book and start to read and go from there. But so that I can have an answer to the question, it's a combination of the familiar and the strange. And what I mean by that is I didn't have any fear of adopting some of the conventions of the epic fantasy sort of subgenre, if you will. When I wrote the first book or any of the Vault of Heaven series, And the reason for that is I feel like I think this is my own coinage, which is trope avoidance is the new trope. there's so many books that try so hard now to avoid seeming like anything else that while they may succeed at that, they feel labored to me. So the inverse risk is that, you know, for a writer like myself, is if I choose to be daring enough not to simply avoid a trope for avoidance sake, then, you know, I'm going to take a few knocks from reviewers, and I have, where they see similarities with other books. The thing that I usually try to say to readers is, because I know the genre so well, I know where I'm stepping. And what that means is I've taken care to sort of lay out a path where I'm going to evolve those tropes that I have elected to adopt beyond your reader assumptions. But that means there needs to be a little sort of investment on the reader's part. And that's a lot to ask. I get it. I had professors in college who would talk about Mark Twain. And, you know, they didn't believe Mark Twain knew what was happening next in his own books. But readers trusted Twain to take them somewhere. And so there's a little bit of that in mind. But having said that, there's also, I think, a great deal of invention. Even in the first book, I took a lot of care to craft new races. You know, I don't fall back on some of the race tropes. There are, you know, there's effectively a character in my series who looks for the home for foundlings and orphans. This is not something I've seen often. And there's a couple of other things that are a little bit more spoiler-esque. If I can say that
you can say it, but can you say it five times fast?
Well, yes. Yeah. No. So, you know, there's going to be things that readers that feel comfortable and familiar to them. There's new things. And there's the first book, the volume that you're reading is there's a lot of foundational stuff there. I'm at the end of writing book two now. And, you know, I find myself really excited and eager for readers to already be into book two with me, because that's where there's a lot of divergence happening from some of those early conventions where I'm trying to set you up for some great aha moments. But, you know, I feel like epic fantasy readers, at least a lot of them, they're kind of in it for the journey. You know, they're coming along for the ride. There's not the immediate gratification that you might have, say, with a thriller novel, which is another genre I also write. So I try and balance those things.
Well, you know, and that's where I think the book has been really refreshing for me as a reader, because we get books sent to us by most of the publishers at this point, and I enjoy everything that I read. I mean, I haven't read anything that I've disliked, but it seems like the last couple of sort of fantasy things that I've read have been kind of what you've described, sort of a, you know, avoiding the trope is the new trope, or just, you know, where it's sort of this, you know, you don't know who is good and who is evil, and you know, it's, you know, kind of like, and I think that all can kind of get traced back recently to the George R. R. Martin books, obviously, where it's, you know, you don't know, there's a lot of scheming going on, and while that's interesting as a reader, sometimes it's hard to sort of really fully care about all of the characters or some of the characters, because, you know, you don't know what they're going to do next, and you don't know what their motivations are all the time. And what I've really been enjoying about The Unremembered so far is I feel like I really care about these characters already. Just to give a little bit of my experience of the book, and I'm only about a third of the way through, is that, you know, it is a fantasy where there's, at least at the early part of the book, where it's sort of like a quest where there's a band of characters and they're friends. And I really feel that friendship, and I feel sort of that sort of love amongst the characters. And I can't remember the last time I read a book, a fantasy book, that has been like that. And I love that. I really care about them. And I like that they care about each other. Is that something that you were thinking about when you were sort of putting this book together? That sort of like friendship and them caring about each other. That's what I'm enjoying the most about it so far.
Yeah, it was. You know,
I so wanted you to say no.
not really.
You've got it all wrong. No, this is one of the tropes I stepped into. Here's the funny thing, right? Is if you're talking about a pre-industrial society, you start to pretty severely limit the number of occupations somebody can have. You're going to have royalty, and that's part of epic or high fantasy, kind of de facto. There's a merchant class, and there's a lot of people who are writing in the merchant class. There's obviously warriors or an army, you know, people of that sort. And then there's sort of the rustics, and these are farmers and hunters and the guy who runs the bar and these kinds of things. And
have you ever read Elie Modisett Jr.?
Yes.
So everybody is a chandler, a scrivener, or a blacksmith.
Yeah, right. And you know, it's fun. It's fun to talk about this, and they're in jokes that we all share who love and you know, participate in the genre in some way. But the reality is that you can work really hard to find that occupation nobody's written about, and then you kind of end up sometimes asking why. So I stepped into this, you know, this trope of I have a number of characters who are from a smaller village. They are friends. There's a couple of things for me. I wouldn't write at all, except there's some days I sit here in this chair that I'm talking to you from, and it's work. It's enjoyable work. I'd prefer it to digging ditches, but I write for those moments of anguish or elation. I want you to be thrilled. This is it's like a personal mantra of mine, and it's actually something that I say as a result of some of my vocal training. I trained with a gentleman by the name of Maestro David Kyle. He was legendary in New York and San Francisco, and ultimately here in Seattle. He taught voice at Radio City Music Hall back in its heyday. He taught for a long time in San Francisco, and when he moved to the Northwest, he started to teach students. You may recognize names like Jeff Tate from Queensryche.
Sure.
Lance Staley from Alice in Chains. Anne and Nancy Wilson from Heart, and the list goes on and on and on. And he taught them a classical voice technique and an ability to use that in a popular music genre, many different genres of music. And I call him my personal Yoda. He would stop our vocal lessons dead, and we recorded them all just to teach me, instruct me. And it sounds maudlin, but so much of any wisdom I really have comes as a result of 400 plus hours of working with this gentleman who has since passed. And he said to me once, and he said it, you know, multiple times since, but he says, I want to be thrilled. And I realize it's the same way I feel about music, and it's the same way I feel about fiction, which is, I want to know who to cheer for. With music, I don't like background music. It's more of an annoyance. And that doesn't mean it has to be loud or heavy or bombastic. But I want to be engaged by it. And it actually annoys me when people talk and I'm listening to music.
I hate that too. I hate it. Actually, I hate it when, now, John is obviously a singer-songwriter. I'm a hobby guitar player. So I say I'm guitar blues man because I play the blues. Oh. And what bugs me is when someone says, hey, come over and bring your guitar. Okay. And then you go over and they say, hey, play us some songs. You say, okay. And then you start playing a song and then people start talking.
Yeah.
Well, then why the hell did you ask me to bring my guitar over here to play some songs?
No, I'm the same way. I mean, it's not that I won't, it's like when I'm, you know, if there's music on in the house, I don't have to be paying attention to it. But if I turn music on because I want to listen to it, it's because I want to listen to it.
Sure.
It's the same way I am with when I'm at the movie theater or even when I'm watching a TV show. I kind of zone everything else out and I don't want the distraction. And in that same idea, that mantra I talk about, I want to be thrilled, it holds for me in fiction. And so while Martin's brilliant and I love his work, there are a lot of writers who have gravitated to this idea of gray. And, you know, they reject this idea, the dichotomy of good and evil. And I get that on one level where, you know, E with a capital E and Snidely Whiplash and Dudley Do-Right, I get it. I don't write that either. But by the same token, while I'm going to take a lot of care to create flaws in my characters and show you some good and the bad and the bad and the good, at the end of the day, I don't want you overly confused about who to cheer for. You know, if I can cause some sadness in you at the demise of my bad guy, bad in quotes, because maybe there were real reasons for their actions, I still don't want you so conflicted that you still don't feel comfortable that the right people prevail, if that's how I choose to write the story. And there's some books that, you know, they feel to me like literary fiction. I got an English degree, and I've read my share of the stories of the woman at the window with the rain and drinking tea, thinking about her mom. And I only need to read one of those, and that's a personal, subjective thing. But I don't really know what to think about or root for with a story like that, and I didn't want that. So I wanted characters. I mean, the one thing that I feel really good about with the book is that most reviewers have seemed to really sort of understand or resonate with the care I took with the characters. And that's probably the highest praise I could receive because I want you invested there.
So well, so hold on a second, John. So you've got a literary degree. You studied music. And you study with a maestro, and you're working at and you're working at Xbox.
That's right.
Well, that
I don't sleep
sense.
A lot.
You know, what cracks me up is, I mean, that it sounds like a humorous career path, but I know so many people who, I mean, it just you never know where you're going to end up or what you're going to be doing. I mean, you're working at Xbox and you're writing books. How cool is that?
Yeah, you know, it's it doesn't suck.
Right.
Yeah.
And is it possible to take a screenshot on an Xbox? I was trying to figure out how to do that.
There's software for that.
I figured there had to be an extra bit somewhere.
And you know, if you have a Kinect, you can take images from your games. So that's a little plug for Kinect.
Well, let me ask. I want to ask Peter one of the points I wanted to in what he was saying is, you know, I'm very invested in the characters in this stage, and I like that about that. It's very clear, and I wanted to sort of make a parallel to music, and I wanted to know how he felt about this. In that, you know, you were saying about, you know, trying so hard to come up with something. You know, some writers or creative folks, you know, are trying to avoid the trope so much. You know, and my feeling on all of this stuff in any creative endeavor is, I think in some ways ideas are overrated, and I've said this before. And what I mean by that is this: I think lots of people can come up with ideas, but it's the execution of those ideas that makes something successful or enjoyable or what have you. A lot of people can have the idea to write a great 3-minute pop song, you know, but to do it is actually pretty hard work in terms of executing it correctly, all the facets that have to go into correcting it. And whereas the idea of writing an epic fantasy novel may not be, you know, a lot of people may have that idea, executing it is a totally different story. So what are your thoughts on that in terms of execution in both in music and in writing?
No, I agree. I forget the name of the band. I was just watching on YouTube. I think it was yesterday. I think it's an Australian band, and they have this hysterical song called the Four Chord Song.
Yes.
Have you seen
it? Yep.
And you know, they go through probably 50 tunes that have the same chord structure, and it's illuminating for the people who listen, because until you hear them string them together, you don't hear, and all they do is pretty much play hits, and you're mm-hmm. like, wow, yeah, it kind of does, but they all sound and feel different. Now, I don't know that all those songwriters, when they set out, said, hey, let's use the same formulaic four chord progression that everybody else uses and write a hit. My gut tells me that most of them set out to write a song, and their heart and ears took them to a certain place with a chord progression and with the lyrics and melodies that they wanted to marry to that progression to convey some emotional, you know, state or emotional feeling. At least that's how, you know, a lot of the music that I've written, we don't simply add a beat to a 4/4 phrase so that it's in 5/4 and then it trips you up and we can be progressive and smarter than you. We write something in 5/4, it's because that's the right signature for the musical phrase we're trying to turn. And so I think that, you know, with music, you know, you learn, you know, you do some study, and then you internalize it. And then when you sit down to write a song, it comes out through the creative process. And for me, it's the same thing with fiction. I continue to study and learn with prose and through great books on the craft of writing. But when I sit down to write, it comes out kind of intuitively. And what that means is, but kind of back to your question, is I don't, if a convention or something serves my story, I don't shy away from it. And but I do take care to take it someplace that is my own. And I get that there's a lot of this in crowd. You know, there's a lot of folks who read a lot of fantasy and they comment and review a lot of fantasy. And so they have knee-jerk reactions to the tropes. And I think it's just a little bit unfortunate for them, because it's a forest for the trees thing. And, you know, because there are enough writers, I guess, who don't take care to make the tropes their own, that some of the reviewers are not going to understand a writer who does get the tropes and is working to kind of take them into new territory. And for me, the opposite side of that coin is simply that some of the fiction I read, it's easy to surprise somebody if you know the tropes. I could sit down and write a story right now that easily avoids every step and every convention of fantasy genre, and it would suck. And I had this conversation with Pat Rothfuss when he was in Seattle. Surprising somebody is easy. Telling a story is not so easy. So coming back, you know, full circle, yeah, writing a song, as simple as it may sound, is not easy, any more than writing a story that trades on some of the, you know, the greatness of the genre conventions is easy. But that's all trappings, guys. I mean, and you know this, you can have a magic user and you could even have elves and dwarves and all the stuff. At the end of the day, it's those characters that are really going to make you care. How many fantasies have you read where you can't tell the plot back to somebody, but you remember the characters that move through that world? My experience is that's most readers' experiences. And so that's where I spend my time.
Great. Well, you know, Peter, I would like to, you know, because you sort of hinted at some of the music, if you don't mind changing gears a little bit over to some of the music stuff. What is, you know, you spoke about voice lessons.
John, you never actually let him, or you never did your thing in the beginning where you say, this is Peter Aurelian and he does this, 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 and this, did you?
Yeah, I think I mentioned that in the beginning. I mentioned that. Yeah.
Well, I know a lot of times you like to ask them, and I'm sorry for kind of derailing you here for a second, but I just thought one of the questions that you like to ask that I've been waiting for you to ask is, like, you know, where did you start and where, you know, how did you, all that
stuff. That's what I was going to get to.
Okay, go. Okay, good. Yeah. Sorry, everybody. Sorry, I screwed him up.
No, what I was going to ask is that, you know, you mentioned that you had taken voice lessons for a long time. What is, you know, and obviously Peter and I kind of had a pretty quick connection through Twitter and Facebook and all that because of our interest in music and in progressive rock in particular. So, Peter, what's your experience in terms of, like, getting into music? I'm assuming you got into it as a younger person. What sort of lead you to progressive rock? And then how do you get involved in sort of singing and writing that kind of music?
You know, probably like a lot of musicians, I was performing standing on the piano bench as a kid in my family room. And it was usually Christmas parties. My family was famous for Christmas parties. And so started there, realized young that I loved to sing. I took piano lessons a couple of different times in my life, so I can play a little bit. But I graduated into a cappella and bel canto in high school. That was a lot of fun. And in high school, I was listening to things like Duran Duran and Tears for Fears and that kind of stuff. And I still think Roland Orzabal with Tears for Fears is one of the great musicians of my generation. But, you know, what happened to me is one evening I was out with some buddies, and they're very dogmatic about their new wave in a world that was seeing 80s hair bands. And the radio station got turned, and Rat was on, and Round and Round was playing. And my life changed. there just was nothing better. Shortly thereafter, I bought a couple of other rock albums, and I realized that I wanted to perform. I wanted to be in a band. You know, I wanted to participate in that. And so I tried kind of with a lot of failed attempts to do that. And then probably a couple of years after that, I auditioned for a group. I got in. That group failed. I got another group. That group failed. I got in another group that ultimately brought me here to Seattle. And part of that move for me was coming up here to train with David Kyle. David taught classical voice technique. So I moved my singing out of the throat into the mask of the face. I learned how to create resonance there, so that I could sing without fatigue, sing with more brightness, sing with a lot more power and a lot more range. And that was always one of my goals. It's meaningful to me personally, even having not done a world tour, that I can hit the notes that Mike Majicevic, I think is how he pronounces it, with Steelheart. You guys remember Steelheart?
Yes, I do.
So, you know, Angel Eyes, I can hit all those notes. I can hit all the notes Jeff Tate hits. And when the day came that with my technique I could do that, I had a personal satisfaction that meant as much as a career in music would. Not that, you know, I would not have liked to have a more successful financial career in music, but I always attained to have a level of proficiency with my voice, and working with David Kyle, I got there. And so, you know, that was, and what has come since then is I've been able to release a couple of CDs. I've been able to tour, mostly in Europe with a couple of different groups. And there's nothing, you know, writing is awesome, guys, but, singing in front of a group of 4,000 or 5,000 people who are hanging on every note and every word, and the immediate gratification that comes from that, there's only one thing better, and I can't talk about that in public.
Well, now dial it back to Christmas and being on the piano bench and singing. Now, did they make you sing Hank Williams and Merle Haggard and Conway Twitty, or was that just me?
That was you. I would like to see that, though.
Yeah. Hello, darling. Nice to see you. You know, it's been a long time. No, sorry.
Peter, you're talking about Jeff Tate and a couple of other singers who I love, and one of the thing that I like about those singers, and it's sort of, you know, to me the ultimate type of voice, at least for a male singer, and that is having that range where you can really hit those notes, but sort of retaining masculinity. and that I think is so hard to do, and there's really only a handful of guys that I can think of that really do that. Jeff Tate is one of them. I always thought Robin Zander from Cheap Trick had a voice quite a lot like that too, where he can really get up there but really sort of maintained sort of a maleness, for lack of a better way of putting it, to that. So
masculinity.
Yeah, I think it works. I think that's, and I don't know if that's something that you sort of strive for as well.
Yeah, you know, for sure. And you know, it's not that I don't like vocalists who, rough the voice. There's, you know, I think Sebastian Bach is a fantastic singer, especially in his early work. And you know, having saying that out, there's going to be people who listen to this who think, oh gosh, that Arulian guy, he's some weird 80s hair band, you know, throwback. And, you know, some of that's true. But the truth is that Sebastian Bach was also classically trained. And the work that he did, especially on early albums, is fantastic. He can hit that scream and it just sounds like it's torture at the bottom of his soul, but it's all with control. Mm-hmm. And I love those guys. There's a guy that sings backup, the drummer for Seven Dust. He's got one of the best rock screams on the planet. But having said that, I still personally have a little bit more affinity for the clarity of voice that you hear with a Jeff Tate or James LaBrie with Dream Theater, or Ray Alder with Fate's Warning. These guys, they have that power. It's not falsetto. Some folks, you know, erringly think that they're going into a falsetto when they get in those upper ranges, and it's not. It's head voice. These guys are, you know, these are trained. And that's kind of my uber point on my, you know, my predilections when it comes to music, and that is, I love music that is composed and yet emotional. The guys from Dream Theater are all Berklee graduates. These guys are musicians at the height of technical proficiency, and yet, you know, you listen to an album like Awake, and it is just, you know, there's soul-rending songs in that album. So back to your point, yeah, these guys have a way of using all of the range and power in a form, even if their hair is long, and yet making it just, it's absolutely got the force of all of their manhood.
You know, that this was not my music. I listened to other stuff. But you know who I always thought, just from a singer standpoint, who was completely underrated as a singer? Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah.
People concentrate on his guitar. They never talk about his singing. And I thought he was just completely underrated as a singer.
Yeah. And you know, I have my own, here's my own little soapbox on it. And I like both stripes, but the two stripes for me is there are true vocalists and then there are stylists. A guy like, Stevie Ray Vaughan for me is a little bit more of a stylist. Eddie Vedder is a stylist. Gosh, I'm blanking on his name. Steven Tyler is a stylist. It isn't that they have an absence of technique, but I don't put them in the same sort of class as I do someone like a Jeff Tate or a James LaBrie.
No.
And I enjoy them both. But if you ask me the Desert Island question, I'm probably taking Jeff.
And now, see, I would be all over B.B. King and Stevie Ray Vaughan and Eric Clapton. Give me that stuff.
Fair enough.
You know, and I want to actually dovetail that into. I have your book in front of me, and I'm looking at the back cover here, and it's got a quote from a blurb from Kevin J. Anderson, who actually was on the show on our podcast. And are you familiar with the albums that he wrote where James LaBrie is singing on? Have you heard those albums yet?
I have. In fact, I got to speak with both Kevin at separate times. I spoke with Kevin about his process, and I also spoke with James, whose name is also Kevin, actually.
Oh, okay.
it's kind of a funny thing. There were two Kevins in the original.
Right. The keyboardist was Kevin Moore, correct?
So they had Kevin LaBrie go by James LaBrie. But yeah, I got to talk to him about it, and it's kind of a neat project they did.
Yeah, absolutely. We had him on, and we talked quite a lot about that. And I was wondering if Kevin was going to have you sing on one of those next projects that he puts out. I think that would be an excellent pairing.
Hey, you should do me a favor and send him an email about that, because I hit him up. I said, hey, you know, and he told me that at the time he was all filled up for his album. I said, okay, well, so I don't know if you know this, but I'm actually working with another musician, and we're writing a concept album to go with The Unremembered.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. Yeah.
We just had a chat about that not too long ago, about how you don't really see concept albums much anymore.
No, and I think it's kind of sad, and I don't know if this is a byproduct of, you know, iTunes, where
oh, it absolutely
all
is.
You know, a la carte.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm just old enough that I kind of get that. Not all, but a lot of musicians took care in the crafting of an album sound and an album story, even if there wasn't a concept. There was an ebb and flow of how they wanted you to experience track to track. And digital kind of screwed that all up. And a lot of listeners, I think even young listeners, they just don't get it. They don't think in those terms anymore. But, you know, I think that it is just a byproduct of the digital age. For a storyteller, it's the perfect, you know, if you're a guy like me and you're a storyteller and a musician, it's the perfect form. And what I'm trying to do with that, and it should be out here in 2-3 months, is do something that's a little unique, where I'm not simply going to do a retelling of The Unremembered. It's what I call additive story. There's a new, not real new, but a fairly new term in the world called transmedia, and it's the idea of additive story, all kind of laddering up to an uber story experience that's told across multiple artistic mediums, using the strength of the various mediums to deliver that story in its own sort of unique way. So a graphic novel does things better than a novel does, and vice versa. Same thing with music, same thing with, you know, webisodes, all this kind of thing. Hollywood's even hiring producers and directors to do transmedia storytelling. And I came upon this notion working at Microsoft, and on a limited scale, of course, that's what I'm trying to do. So the concept album I'm doing is not a retelling. I'm actually going, there's a character in the book. I don't know if you've run upon him yet, John, but he's Mysteri, and Mysteri are sort of stewards of song in my world. And it's going to tell a little bit of the backstory of that character, and also a little bit of the backstory of something called The Song of Suffering, which is a musical concept and power in my world. And so listeners who hear the album are going to have a deeper appreciation for those parts of the novel. And, you know, people who read the novel and have read the album listen to the album, going to have a little bit kind of a resonant experience there. They're not dependent on each other, but it's a fun way for people who like both mediums to kind of enlarge their experience.
Well, that's great. You know, I mean, that to me, you know, it's funny. J.C. Hutchins, who's an author, he wrote a nice blog post about sort of that transmedia sort of storytelling, which seems very in line with what you're talking about here. I'll have to email you the link to that article you wrote. It's a lot of what you're just talking about there. But that's you know, what kind of led me into my own sort of art, was that I thought, well, I love science fiction books and I love music. What if I write stuff that's sort of tells both? And I think we're sort of in a world where that can happen, where, you know, you can have all these different media to experience something. And I'm, you know, I know that's something that I've been trying to do for the past couple of years, and I'm super excited that that's going to be coming down from you as well. Before we start wrapping it up, though, because we are kind of getting to the end of our time, I have an
Xbox question too when you're done, John.
All right. God damn it, Patrick. the one question, there is a minor character in the beginning named Getty. I'm assuming that's a Rush Getty reference. It's got to be, right?
I'm taking the fifth.
Okay. I'm like, yes. Yes. Anyway, okay. Patrick, ask your Xbox.
I will just say this. There are a lot of Easter eggs in mm-hmm. novel and in all of the other transmedia type things I'm doing, whether it's webisodes or art or even the map of my world for people who are into anagrams.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fantastic. That's great. I'm super excited to keep finishing up the novel and to check out the album. Patrick, why don't you totally derail the conversation and ask your Xbox question now?
I'm just we have functional nerds.com, and on there we're having people review books and stuff. And I put out a call. I said, hey, I want people to review video games. And someone asked me a question that I didn't know how to answer. It was essentially, how do you send me the games to review? And I said, well, I'm not sending you any games to review. And they said, well, aren't you on a list like with the publishers? I didn't know lists existed for so I'm just curious, as an Xbox guy, who do I call? Where do I write?
Send me an email. And what I'll do is I will work with our, are two. See, we think of it in terms of first party and third party. Microsoft has its own game studio for things like Halo and Gears of War and Fable and, you know, these kinds of franchises. Most games obviously come from a plethora of other, sure, like EA and Activision and 2K, all these guys. And we have folks that work along both sides of that publishing ecosystem. And I can plug you in so that you can get, because if you're really going to legitimately review video games, there's no reason why you couldn't get on those lists to get those games.
That's what I want to do. I mean, we're doing books. We got a food nerd now who's doing food stuff. Oh. We've got a comic book nerd who's doing Sunday comic picks.
Yeah.
We've got a music nerd doing music stuff. I want a video game nerd.
Yeah, I'll do everything I can to hook you up. Just send me a mail offline.
And then my other question is, why doesn't Microsoft get the guy who created Oddworld to make a new damn game? Because that would be awesome.
Send me a mail about that.
All right, well, let's wrap it up here. So once again, Peter has The Unremembered, which is out by Tor now. It is in all the bookstores. You should be able to find that pretty easily, as well as at Amazon and all that kind of jazz. Peter, why don't you when are we looking at the second book coming out? When do we have a release date for that one yet?
There's not a release date. I think I'm probably about 3 or 4 weeks from finishing the first draft and right at the end game. Then I'll go through and do a polish edit of my own before I send it to my editor. And then it's really going to be up to the publisher, you know, when they slate it for release. Sometimes they're sort of incentivized to try and get these out more quickly so that readers don't have a long delta between books. But it's just going to be all in their, you know, their wisdom.
Great, so good. And then why don't you spoke a little bit about the album, when is sort of the ballpark date for that to be out, you think?
Yeah, early summer. The music is almost entirely written, and I am now going through and writing all the lyrics and melodies. One of the things I am doing, planning to do, is with several of the tracks, release significant clips just out for people who are interested. I don't know if that's the kind of thing you guys are interested in. If you are, if you've got a place in your web presence, if you want to, would like to host a clip here or there, let me know. I'm glad to do that. I want people to sample.
Sure, sure. We could totally do that. That's great. So,
have you ever met the Master Chief?
You know, I've met the voice of Master Chief. for sure. And I've met the voice of Cortana.
is she hot?
Talent.
Is she hot?
She's hot. Yeah.
Ah, yes. I'm gonna get in so much trouble for that comment, by the way.
Yeah, all right. It's true.
You know the guy who does a bunch of the voices for the World of Warcraft. He's like this voice actor, and he's like this huge gamer nerd. But he did a bunch of voices for World of Warcraft, and now he's running a singles game or a singles nerd match website kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah. How weird is that?
Yeah, anyway. It's the nerddom. It's a tighter knit community than you can imagine. I mean, that one of the cool things for me in my travels at Xbox is I worked for a long time on the entertainment stuff on the console. So the film and TV integrations, what we did with music, what we did with Netflix and, you know, all of this stuff. And through all of that, I got to meet Felicia Day.
I got to meet her. I got to meet her at BlizzCon. Well, she was awesome.
I actually sent her, she's reading my book right now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, you know, these are the kind of fun things that I have to thank Microsoft for, that I've got to meet some really cool people.
I got to meet the entire cast of the Guild at BlizzCon. I tried to turn my video on so you could see it, but it's not working. Behind me on the wall, I have a limited edition Guild piece of art that has the entire crew, and then I got them all to sign it.
Hey, well, let me see if I can one-up you. Before the Guild became like widely known, they were part of what was called a Greenlight Project at the very first inaugural Greenlight Awards and competition at South by Southwest. which Xbox and yours truly sponsored, and I actually got to be a judge that selected the guild as a winner that helped kind of propel them a little bit into the limelight, because we actually then signed the guild to an exclusive deal on Xbox Live. So they've been close to my heart from the very beginning.
That's awesome. You know, I people of this podcast know I give Microsoft some shit. But I, one of the things that I have always admired them for was the deal that they did make with Felicia Day. And that has helped to keep the guild going, and actually has made it better because they actually have a budget and they can do some cool stuff now. You know, they got Will Wheaton on there, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's been awesome. And I think it's cool. I think that's the way to do digital content, because it appears first on Xbox, you know, cause you guys pay for it.
Yep.
And then they're allowed to release it, you know, on their website or on YouTube or whatever, for, you know, the people who don't have the Xbox marketplace.
That's right. And it's, you know, you have to give a lot of props to Felicia and her crew. So they're such creative folks. But I think you're right. I think where big corporations like Microsoft can really make a difference is when they have folks who are kind of dialed in to some of that culture and can enable them, you know, without sort of trying to come in and micromanage the creativity. And I think the Guild's a good example of where we did some good stuff.
Yeah, I cannot wait for her new series.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. It's going to be awesome.
Dragon Age, right?
Yep. Yeah. All right. Peter, why don't you, to wrap it up, why don't you throw out your website and your Twitter and all that kind of jazz where people can find you?
Yeah. So my website's just my last name, Aurulian.com. That's O-R-U-L-L-I-A-N. And all the stuff we've been talking about here, all the webisodes and all the art and the map. And the map's interactive, by the way. I've got a lot of friends who do digital work. So we've really tried to create a lot of fun stuff on my website. My Twitter's Peter Aurelian. That's kind of simple. I do have a MySpace page, but I don't keep up on that one quite as well as I do my Facebook. My Facebook is Vox One. So, you know, that's, you know, pretty transparent, because that was always my tag on the soundboard. So
you heard that MySpace had a server problem and they went down and nobody cared.
I wouldn't have known, because I don't check.
Right. Fantastic. All right. Well, Peter, thanks so much for joining us. It was a real pleasure to have you on. And when the album comes out, let us know, because, you know, we'll have you back on the show. We can talk about that too.
That's great. And I'll be sure you guys get a copy.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks, Peter.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
And we're back. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Peter Aurelian. Please go check out his book and go check out his website. I think you will enjoy it very much. Me this week, again, I have the Books, Bytes, and Bots EP out at johnanilio.bandcamp.com. By the time this airs, hopefully I'll have a new video over at wired.com. My Geek Dad guitar lesson series. I did Rock Lobster by the Beatles, because there was a request for that. So
wait, Rock Lobster by the Beatles?
Not the Beatles, B-52s, sorry.
The B-52s, yeah. I was going to say, what album was that on?
It's late, man. It's late on. I got my son's only 5 years old, and we listen to a lot of kids' music in the car, and I finally turned him on to the Beatles, so we've been listening to Rubber Soul on a loop
nice. The
car, so that's been really very enjoyable lately. But anyway, so I got those couple things going on, so please check that out. Also, by the time this airs, I might have a new post up over at SF Signal with Peter V. Brett. It's a music post about what authors listen to when they're writing. So Peter did that, and I just have to post it up there. So take a look out for that too. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
I have a recap of Doctor Who episode on sfsignal.com that I didn't like it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have tons of stuff over on atfmb.com this week. I got a bug up my butt and I just kept writing over the weekend. I told you I broke 40K in the novel. I actually am now at like 43-ish. This is the complete and total rewrite of the novel. I completely got my days wrong. I thought last Saturday I was going to writer's group, but actually it's this next Saturday, which now, because of the weird time loop, timey-wimey wobbly thing with the podcast that we do with the podcast, it'll actually be last Saturday by the time this airs, and now my brain hurts. But they got to read the first 50 pages of the novel, and so they're going to come back and tell me how much it sucks.
Well, that's part of the process now, isn't it?
Yes. So I'm gearing up. I'm getting my thick skin going for that. You know, there's a lot of speculation out there about why there are so many male writers versus female writers. And I think it actually comes just from men are more prone to have tough skins because we're rejected all the time by women. And so that kind of helps us when we query and stuff. You know, it's like we get rejected. Ah, we got rejected. No big deal. That's my theory anyway. I could be completely wrong.
That one.
I could be completely wrong. And I'm sure I'll get the hate mail to go with that. Yeah. Other than that, let's see. SF Signal, we're going to have another interview. I can't remember who's over there. So I do the other podcast over there. What else? Twitter.com/ATFMB, ATFMB.com. Functional Nerds. On FunctionalNerds.com this week, we've got a new review from Paul Weimer. Weimer. He just told me how to pronounce that, and I've already forgotten it. So he's got that. Kate Sherrod has another Sunday Picks up. So that was kind of cool. Feeding Ground, I think, was the one that's up right now. Lots of cool stuff going on over there. And there's the webcomic is still going, so shadowbites.com. Get into that because we're having a lot of fun doing that. I think that's pretty much it for right now.
All right. Sounds very good. Well, we will see you next week. Thanks for joining us this week for the Functional Nerds. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Oh, I should have asked him about the power supply problems on the Xbox. Damn it. Oh, well. We'll see you next week.
All right. Bye. She's a porn bot. I think I love her. She's a porn bot. I think she cares. She's a porn bot. She's not like the other girls. She's a porn bot. She cares for me. She's in it for the fun. She wants to meet